Hello, everybody. Welcome in to the Lakers Collective. I'm Trevor Lane, joined as always by Jason Timpf and Jovan Buha. We've got a lot to talk about today because the Lakers, they just keep on winning. Picked up the big win last night over the Clippers, making it five in a row. They are advancing out of their group in the NBA Cup tournament. So we'll talk a bit about last night's game, about the five-game win streak, what the context is behind this Lakers win streak and where they currently sit when we dive into their advanced metrics, the offensive rating, defensive rating, net rating, things like that. We'll talk about the Lakers' big three, how LeBron, Luka, and Austin Reeves are playing together. They all put up big numbers last night, 99 points combined. Yeah, that's probably going to get it done. And of course, we'll do a little Q&A with all of you joining us live. Please make sure you do subscribe right here to the channel if you've not done so yet. Help us grow. Hit that subscribe button and check out the podcast feed as well. You can find the Lakers Collective over on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts. Guys, the Lakers, like I said, they keep on winning. We've got Thanksgiving tomorrow. It's that time of year. I'm happy. How are you guys doing?
It's good to see you guys. Thanksgiving week is like the first little break we get in this crazy blitz from late October to now. So it's always nice to hit that first little quarter pole, so to speak, of the NBA season where we can take a little bit of a rest. I hope you guys also will have some time to relax today and tomorrow. But yeah, like the Lakers just keep on winning, man. I'm excited to dive into that game from last night. It was super interesting.
I'm thankful to be here with you guys. I'm thankful to be here with the chat. And yeah, I mean, this five-game win streak, I think eight games is in play, nine games is in play going into that road trip. So things are looking pretty good for the Lakers.
Yeah, looking good indeed. And again, everybody, fire off your questions, your comments in the chat. Yes, you notice I am not in my normal studio. It is the holidays, so I am visiting the in-laws right now in South Carolina, which made it fun being on Eastern time for last night's 8 p.m. start. Jovan, I mean, you were in the building. Was it different? I mean, it's only, what, 30, 40-ish minutes later than a normal game, but did it feel a lot later having an 8 p.m. start time?
Yeah, I would say even more than that because they recently shifted over the last few years. Like since I started covering the NBA in 2011, and it felt like that first decade, maybe like post-COVID, there was a shift where it was often 7:30 for Lakers games at home. And then over the last few years, it shifted to 7 p.m. So most Laker games at home, at least, are at 7 p.m. with the exception of some of those like Saturday or Sunday games where they'll sometimes bump them up a little bit. But having an 8 p.m. tip off, and really it was 8:15 when the game actually started. The game didn't end until I believe around like 10:50-ish Pacific time, and then I didn't get home from the game until right before midnight. So it was definitely a wild night. Also went out of order post game where Luka went first, then JJ and LeBron went at the same time. So everybody was trying to get out of their post game and just scrambling. I don't think the crowd was great. I thought, you know, maybe a little bit of a slow start with just how the game kind of started. But then especially in the second half, like the crowd was incredible.
Well, let's dive into the game itself. What did you guys, you know, the Lakers do pick up the big win over the Clippers, but they didn't really pull away until midway towards maybe closer to the end of the third quarter. It felt like every time they tried to get a lead or try to build any kind of a cushion, the Clippers would come right back. Jason, what did you see in this win against the Clippers last night? What was your take on it?
First of all, Jovan, I was feeling it when it was 11:30 local time here in Denver. And I was trying to do my instant reaction, and my brain was just absolute mush. Especially since I've been on this cadence where I've been getting up at 5:30 every morning, and then all of a sudden, I'm just awake way later than I usually am. But I thought this game was super fascinating. There's been this trend throughout this season where the Laker defense has taken a little while into games to kind of figure things out, and I thought yesterday was no exception. They really struggled guarding James Harden for the first 2.5 quarters. Some game plan discipline stuff. They kept letting him get to his left hand, which very much was not the game plan. They were trying to funnel him to his right. And then to the Clippers' credit, when they would send him to his right, there were, you know, help defense sequences set up in a way that was conceding some of these corner threes to John Collins and to Chris Dunn and to Nick Batum. And they were just making shots early in the game. They shot extremely well off of those kickouts. And for the record, don't get too worked up about that, Lakers fans. James Harden's been frying the entire NBA for about 3 weeks to this point. So that is a big part of it. In that second half, though, they started to figure out some things that worked. More blitzing in his ball screens. And then in his ISOs, they were doing some of the most aggressive gapping you'll ever see. They were coming so high off the corners where Harden would be ISOing someone up top, and there would be two defenders damn near at the elbows, almost in like a soft triple team, basically just forcing James Harden to give up the basketball so that they could rotate out of it. And then one of the things I've consistently noticed over the course of this season so far is Luka, like right in that late third quarter stretch, he gets a little bit less step back three happy and gets a little bit more to the basket aggressive. This has been something that's been a big trend over the course of the last few games. And there was a centerless group for the Clippers where they had John Collins basically playing the five in that late third quarter stretch. And Luka was just crazy aggressive getting down into that like 5 to 10 foot range for shorter, easier shots. Attacking Kobe Sanders over the top, drawing multiple defenders for those drop off passes. And that sparked the initial run, which then fed into that fourth quarter group with Austin and LeBron, which has been literally crushing teams again this year. 52 possessions, according to Cleaning the Glass, plus 31 net, scoring the ball extremely well, getting a ton of stops, and they just came in and slammed the door shut. And then when Luka came back, they were able to get into some of their tic-tac-toe sequences off of Luka blitzes where Austin was scoring the basketball. I honestly thought from about that mid-third quarter stretch to the end of the game was some of the best basketball the Lakers have played all season on both ends of the floor. Extremely impressive stuff. I'm excited to dig into some of the contextualization of this team because I think they're better than even what this some of the stuff in the conversation surrounding their net rating would lead you to believe. I thought yesterday was one of their best performances of the season.
Jovan, you mentioned the crowd was pretty fired up that run midway through the third quarter all the way through the end where the Lakers really put their foot down on the gas, took it to the Clippers. That must have had the building absolutely rocking.
Yeah, and I would even go back to the first quarter where Luka's longstanding blood feud with the Clippers continued, where this dude just hates the Clippers. It's just like, it's apparent, and it's personal. They beat him twice in the playoffs to start his postseason career, and he has not forgotten about that. And so 24 points in the first quarter, season high for Luka, hit 5 threes. When his step back three is falling, there's literally nothing you can do. There's no way to guard this guy. You blitz him and he's going to create those 4-on-3 opportunities, or he's beaten the trap sometimes. And like that was an incredible display from Luka, and probably his best quarter of the season, you know, even beyond just scoring a season high. Like I thought just the way that he managed that quarter and the way that he ripped the Clippers hearts out, it was pretty wild. The Lakers are actually down by one despite that. Yeah. But he's jawing at the Clippers bench, and I love when Luka just starts trash talking the opposing coaching staff and is like, you know, play up on me, like come up higher. It's just like, this guy's a complete insane person in the best way possible. So that was really fun. But yeah, that stretch there, like the Lakers, because they started to distance themselves in the third quarter. They got up to, LeBron hits a mid-range jumper, they go up 10, and then all of a sudden the Clippers respond with this big run to regain the lead, and then they're trading baskets. A bunch of wild sequences in this game in the sense of like how many replay review, like that also extended the like they're at least like 20 to 25 extra minutes of game time because of the replays. There were several replays that went against the Lakers. I thought, I typically don't go at the officiating. I thought it was an oddly officiated game, and there was a bunch of weird calls on both sides, but certainly that sucked the life out of the game at times. But I thought that run to close the third quarter, because they were kind of on the ropes there for a little bit. They closed the third quarter with some momentum. Then they just blow things open in the fourth quarter. Jason mentioned the Austin-LeBron telepathy that those two have with their two-man game. Austin scores 12 points in, I believe, like the first 4 or 5 minutes of the fourth quarter, had 18 in the fourth overall. So he's been awesome in fourth quarters. He's leading the Lakers in scoring in the fourth. He took over the game in that sense. And they just, it was a masterclass from the big three. And like those three scored 99 points, I believe, on 34-59 shooting. And it felt like there's so much more in terms of the level they could get to.
Yeah, really quickly on that, the 3-point shooting, I wanted to shout out. Luka came into the game shooting just 29.9% on step back threes. And he was 6-for-12 last night. So a good bit of positive regression there that I think, is a positive sign of him starting to get a rhythm on that end of the floor.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly what I was gonna go to here, because the Lakers, there are two big statistical areas of weakness that we've seen that we've been keeping an eye on throughout the season. It's been the three-point shooting, and we've been saying all along, hey, they're probably not really a 33-32% three-point shooting team. They're going to be a bit better than that, so expect there to be some positive regression games. 45% from three as a team last night. Luka, LeBron, Austin were what, 4 for 24, I think it was, in their previous game, and they still managed to eke out that win over the Utah Jazz. Last night's game, obviously, much, much, much better than that from deep. And then the turnovers, only 11 turnovers in last night's game. They've been one of the higher turnover teams in the NBA. The Clippers have been a high turnover team as well. The Lakers ranking 27th in turnovers per game. 11 turnovers, a really big step forward there. And so I want to ask you guys, looking at those two key areas, is that sustainable? Not necessarily 11 turnovers, because that's pretty damn low, but improved play in terms of not turning the ball over, being more efficient with the three-point shooting. Was this a hot night from both of those categories, or was there some sustainability in what we saw there?
You know, this is something I'm going to have my eye on for most of the season, because specifically, you know, for the Lakers in their transition defense, they've been sneaky good in their transition defense, but the one spot where they have been bad is off of turnovers. In transition situations off of turnovers, they allow the team to get out in transition on 70% of their turnovers. And they give up a 142 offensive rating off of turnovers in transition. Those are two really weak marks in an otherwise pretty strong transition defense. Cleaning the glass has a catch-all transition defense metric, points added per 100 possessions, and they rank 11th in the league in that spot. So they're actually a pretty solid transition defense overall, but they can have some issues versus turnovers. And it's really just a simple floor balance issue. A lot of these ball screen attacks with Austin and Luka, when they have someone rolling, which again, Ayton and Jackson are rollers, they're not poppers. And so when you run a ball screen off the top and you've got a guy attacking downhill and a guy rolling downhill, often you'll only have like one player wheel up off the weak side. And so then you can end up in some poor floor balance situations where you have four of your defenders, or four of your transition defenders, so to speak, south of the free throw line, which can be really difficult to get back. And so honestly, ball security in those ball screens, particularly from Luka and Austin, those are going to be absolutely key things to watch throughout the season, because if they turn the ball over there, it's a bucket going the other way most of the time. They're more often than not pick sixes, and they can be really difficult to overcome. So a good step forward last night. I also think in general, there's still, you know, as much natural offensive talent there is on this group, in this group that's kind of coming together beautifully, there is a certain amount of like newness to this still, especially with LeBron back and with some of the guys that have been in and out of the lineup to start the year. I think over the course of the season, they'll start to figure out how to limit some of those mistakes.
Yeah, I don't think the turnovers are sustainable just because 11 is such a low number, but can you consistently be ideally in that 12 to 14 range, 12 to 15, like you really shouldn't be turning the ball over more than 15 times in a serious game in an ideal sense. So I thought that the ball control was much better. I mean, this to me was clearly their best offensive performance of the three games that they've had now with LeBron, and especially factoring in the opponent, like the Clippers are clearly going through it right now, that they are a bit of a mess, but I still think that talent with Kawhi, Harden, and Zubats is at a different level than, say, the Utah Jazz, right? So there was a respectability there of them doing that versus this opponent versus, say, doing that against the Jazz. But in terms of the three-point shooting, this was actually the Lakers' season high in three-point percentage. 44.8% was a season-high mark, and 13 threes marked, was tied for the third most threes the Lakers have made in a game this season. Their season high is 15. So this has been a relatively low-volume three-point shooting team. They've only attempted more than 40 threes one time this season, which was against Miami. They attempted 46. So the issue has been, you can't be a low volume three-point shooting team and a bad three-point shooting team. You have to be like, you either have to kind of increase the volume and kind of get by in that sense, or you have to be efficient. And I thought tonight, or excuse me, last night, 29 attempts is pretty low, but hitting 13 of them and shooting basically 45% on them, that's pretty good. That's pretty efficient. So I think the Lakers have been due for regression to the mean with their shooters. Right now, you look at the rotation, Rui's the only every night player who is shooting above league average from three. which is just astounding. He's shooting 48%. So that's going to come down probably to the low to mid 40s. But everybody else, like Jake right now, is someone who started hot, has cooled off. LeBron has only three games, but has not been back to his 40-ish percent. Luka's due to get back to league average. Austin's due to get back to league average. So I think that they have several guys here who are due to progress to the mean. And that, I think longer term indicates like the offense is going to get even better, right? Like these shots are going to start to fall. And if they can continue to clean up the ball handling, the decision-making, the processing and the turnovers plus better shooting, that's where I just don't know how you guard this offense.
And that's exactly where I've landed with this team as well. I've taken the glasses half full approach. They are 10th now after last night's game in offensive rating that they ultimately can be a top five, maybe top three offense in the NBA when you do get that positive regression from three and you do get a little bit more ball control on the in terms of the turnovers. They can rise up a lot in terms of their overall offensive efficiency. They're still just scratching the surface of what they can be. And that's what's really, really exciting about this club. But Jason, Jovan was just talking about efficiency from three versus volume from three, and you got to be good at least one of those two areas. Which one of those paths can the Lakers, can they be a low volume, high efficiency three-point shooting team? Do they need to increase the attempts? What are your thoughts on their shooting from deep?
So I think it's both, but follow me here for a second, because I think they're kind of connected to each other in a lot of ways. So there's two ways of looking at it. There's a shot selection element as it pertains to the off the dribble threes that Austin and Luka are taking. And there's a certain amount of like, let's refine that a little bit, but you're missing it if you think that's the only reason their 3-point percentage is low. 20 of the 30 NBA teams are shooting over 40% on unguarded catch and shoot threes this year, according to Synergy, and the Lakers are not one of those 20 teams. So they are missing their unguarded catch and shoot threes too. Now, so I think on the volume side of it, there's a certain amount of like a few more of those possessions where instead of Austin and Luka settling for a step back three off the dribble, they make some sort of dribble probe that initiates one of their driving kick sequences to try to get more of those catch and shoot threes. And then the second piece of it is actually paying off those unguarded catch and shoot threes. Jovan mentioned it earlier. I do expect LeBron, according to Synergy, he's taken 9 catch and shoots. 2 have been unguarded. 7 have been guarded. He's missed all 7 of the guarded, and he's made both of the unguarded. And he made one of those wide open threes on the left wing in the early fourth quarter yesterday off of a kick out from Austin. I expect LeBron to be a knockdown 3-point shooter. That's not something I'm worried about. Rui has obviously proven that for years now. To me, Austin and Luka are the two guys I got my eye on in this regard. So the two of them right now are a combined 12 for 35 on unguarded catch and shoot threes. That's obviously barely over 33%. That's not going to cut it. Both of those two guys in particular, especially when they start playing better defenses, because what's going to end up happening, when you're playing the really bad defenses, that like first ball screen leads to a kick out and there's a wide open three. Kind of like what happened in the Clippers sequence that I just mentioned when LeBron got the wide open three on the weak side. Austin attacks the ball screen. Kawhi comes over and tags the roller. LeBron's open on the weak side. Austin makes a beautiful skip. LeBron knocks down the three. Against an elite defense, there's an extra layer to that rotation coming from the top that's going to get driven by LeBron into the next kind of sequence. And many of those are going to end up back in Austin or back in Luka's hands in catch and shoot situations. Austin did hit a big catch and shoot three off of the right corner, off of a low man tag from Luka yesterday. But there are going to be a lot more of those sequences that end up in those guys' hands, and they got to knock them down. I keep thinking about the 2024 Boston Celtics. There's a vibe with their driving kick attack where it kind of felt like you couldn't leave any of their guys open. Whereas with this version of the Lakers team, there have been a couple of guys where it's like, you can live with that guy taking a catch and shoot three. And Austin and Luka have been in that
boat. A couple.
So the big thing that I have my eye on throughout the rest of the season on the Lakers on the offensive end, I know they're going to break defenses down. There's too much talent there. I know they're going to make those connective plays. There's too much talent there. Can they finish plays? That's going to be the key, and it's going to come down to like Marcus not being a mid-20s three-point shooter, but a mid-30s three-point shooter. Jake LaRavia getting up into the high 30s. LeBron and Rui being in the mid-40s, and Luka and Austin being in that like 40-42% range on catch-and-shoot threes. I think that's the key. And then upping the volume by settling a little less often for those early clock step-back threes.
all of that is going to be important for this Lakers team as they continue to move forward here and are able to start really pushing themselves offensively. Because I think we all agree that defensively, the ceiling's probably not nearly as high as it is offensively. That's where they're going to really be able to move this team forward and really give teams problems. And it's what's exciting about this club. In addition to, if you can add a few pieces around the trade deadline, particularly on the defensive side of the ball, that's where this team can really, truly take off. Let's take a look, though, here. We do have one super chat coming in here that's mentioning a trade. Guys, we are going to get to all of the super chats when we get to the Q&A section. Just want to throw it out there. If you guys have them, go ahead and get them in. But Wiggins, De'Ron Sharpe make us serious contenders. I mainly wanted to get – we've talked a lot about Andrew Wiggins already, but I wanted to get your guys' thoughts on adding a big to this team real quick before we talk about the next steps when we look at the big three. We look at contextualizing this 13-4 start. Jackson Hayes, I thought, filled in pretty admirably last night for DeAndre Ayton. Do the Lakers need another big physical presence out there on the trade market? Jovan, is that something they should be targeting in addition to wing depth, or should they just be focused on 3-and-D style wings?
I don't think they need it. I think it could be a luxury to have, right? That's still a look that they don't necessarily have with the center rotation right now. Like, even as well as Jackson played last night, and I do think he played really well, especially we referenced that fourth quarter sequence where he was short. He had all three of his assists in the fourth quarter in the short role playmaking. And I think the rim protection has been better. The rebounding, I think, has even been better at times. Still, we saw, like, Zubats had six offensive rebounds. He was able to push Jackson around. The Lakers had to double anytime he got the ball in the post. And even then, Zoo was able to push Jackson around a bit. So I think looking specifically at the three other top teams in the West with Jokic, with Hartenstein, and with Adams and Şengün, like, you do need some strength and girth and weight against those three teams and those bigs specifically. I think DeAndre Ayton can largely hold up fine against them, but it would be nice to have, like, it would be great if the Lakers could add a Steven Adams off the bench, right? And you're not finding that player necessarily, but with Sharp, I like Sharp, and he is a big physical young big. So I think for me, it would not be the thing I'm primarily targeting. I think the clear thing remains that fifth starter and someone who is a blend of what Rui and Marcus bring in terms of being an offensive threat, but also being a multi-positional defender. If you can add that player plus another big that gives you a different look, I would like that. But the Lakers have limited assets right now in terms of making a trade. So I would not prioritize that at the expense of a potential fifth starter.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. That's exactly where I've been as well. That it would be nice to have, but it's not a must have for the Lakers. All right, guys, and we're going to get into more of your comments in just a moment. Jason, I know you really want to sink your teeth into contextualizing this 13-4 start. A lot of people have been looking at the net rating for the Lakers and saying this is an indication that this is fool's gold. They're not really all that good. Right now, they're 14th in the NBA in net rating. So, Jason, what do you have on this? I know this is something you wanted to get into here.
Yeah, so this is just something that I've noticed kind of being a prevailing talking point, especially among the people who cover the league nationally. Essentially, this idea that the Lakers are not as good as their record because of the simple fact that their offense and defensive ratings are both average. And on the one hand, I want to be very clear, like, ideally, it wouldn't be that way. Ideally, they'd be top five in both offense and defense, and some really strong statistical markers that kind of align with the way their record has shown up to this point. However, I don't remember seeing any games this year where it felt like the Lakers, you know, except for maybe Austin winning on the road in Minnesota. Like, there were most of these games feel like the Lakers have been the better team in the games that they've won. It hasn't felt like the Lakers have been like fool's gold stacking up wins. But I do think it's important to try to explain, like, why is it that the Lakers haven't had as strong of a statistical set of markers compared to some of the other teams that have great records in the league? And there's a couple of important pieces of context. So for starters, guys in and out of the lineup. They're 13-4, but they have done so with LeBron largely missing the majority of the season to this point, and Luka and Austin both missing chunks of games. And so they haven't had all of their talent available. Now, that the same can be said for some of the other teams at the top. But I would argue, if you're looking at top-end talent being available, the Lakers have been towards the bottom of the league in availability in that regard. And I think it's something that has affected some of their statistical markers. The second piece of it is this team has a certain personality to it. Again, you would prefer for them to come out in the first quarter of every game and kick everybody's butt and go from there. But there has been a pretty steady flow here with this team. So this team is actually just plus 0.2 points per 100 possessions in the first half. That is where they're really handicapping their statistical performance. They have been an extremely mediocre first half team, but consistently, kind of like what we saw last night, where they really tighten the screws defensively in the third quarter. Luka gets more physically aggressive in the paint to end the third quarter. All of a sudden, this LeBron and Austin unit comes in and kicks butt to start the fourth. Then Luka comes back and closes the deal. That's been a pretty consistent trend throughout the season, obviously without LeBron for the majority of it. But they have a plus 6.2 net rating in the second half. That is the sixth best marker in the entire NBA. For all the talk about their defense, if you look at just defenses in the second half of games this season, the Lakers have a top five defense in the second half of games this season. They have consistently tightened the screws, engaged themselves defensively, made the necessary game plan adjustments like we talked about last night with James Harden, been a little bit more swarming, a little bit more dynamic on the back line, and they've gotten the stops that they've needed. They are outscoring teams by 9.5 points per 100 possession. Per 100 possessions in the fourth quarter. That is the fourth best net rating out of any team in the NBA in the fourth quarter. They have the fourth best defense in fourth quarters in the NBA this season. And then obviously 6-0 in clutch games, outscoring teams by 30 points per 100 possessions in clutch situations, which is the third best mark in the NBA. And they have the very best clutch defense in the league. So what I would kind of translate that or synthesize that down into one kind of singular talking point: this team has not been a very engaged or dominant team in the first half, but the reason why they're 13-4 is they've been one of the best second half teams in the league. When it comes down to winning time, they tighten the screws on defense, their stars get more deliberate and decisive with the way they're attacking, and they just execute the way they need to execute and make pivotal runs late in games, and they put teams away. And that is a hallmark of an elite team. And so, yeah, are they going to need to eventually clean up some of their first half stuff to start putting up net rating numbers like Houston and Denver? That's true. But I do think that this team has been consistently dominant in winning time, and that has been kind of glossed over because people are not looking past the big picture numbers.
You know, that's interesting because you're on the money with all of that. And I didn't realize that going into this show that they were that good. I knew they had really turned things on in the second half of games, but even I didn't realize that they are sixth in net rating in the second half and fifth in defensive rating in the second half. Even offensive rating wise, they're eighth in offensive rating in the second half as well. Part of me thinks, my initial thought is, well, that's what happens when you've got a guy like Luka, when you've got guys like Austin that can help you close out games, guys who have been in. They have, despite not being, I think, an old team, that they have guys who have experience, who are veterans in that sense and have been in moments like these, and now you're adding LeBron into this mix. I think some of it is the experience. They're seeing their way through games. They're finding there is that chemistry, a little bit of holdover from last season, plus you add in guys like Marcus Smart, like Ayton, who have picked their spots very, very well, and so they're finding ways to get wins, and that's been, I think, one of the hallmarks of this team is they're finding ways to get the job done, even though it might not be the exact same way every single night. But Jovan, what do you attribute this second half improvement to? Because as we talk about this team as not a good defensive team, and I think it's fair given their personnel to recognize that they probably need improvement on the defensive end of the floor, yet here they are, fifth in defensive rating in the second half. How do you ultimately synthesize all of that? What do you take that down into? Is it they just need to play harder in the first half, or is this a sign of something else?
Well, to me, it's a sign that they need to change the starting lineup. And because if we...
I knew we would go there.
Which you knew I was going to bring it back to this. If we actually break it down by quarter, here is the Lakers net rating by quarter. And I'm not going with the decimals here, just going, you know, general. Minus five in the first quarter, which is 20th in the NBA. So that they are a bottom 11 first quarter team plus six in the second quarter, plus three in the third quarter, and then 9.5, we'll say, just to not split, you know, round up in the fourth. So there's a clear trend here where the Lakers have been unable to find a successful starting lineup up to this point in the season. And if you, I mean, just with LeBron back, and if we're just judging it off of quality of opponent, the Lakers have played two bad teams since LeBron has been back, like based on record and performance and whatnot. The starting groups, that there's been two, the one with Jackson, one with Ayton, they're a minus 10 in 36 minutes right now, with, again, like subpar competition, lottery competition. Like, these should be minutes that the Lakers are winning. And of course, there's going to be some element of figuring it out on the fly with LeBron. But in particular, I think the quartet of big man plus Luka plus Rui plus Austin has underachieved for most of the season. And I think that there's a clear correlation between the Lakers with Rui on the floor with the starters versus Marcus on the floor with the starters. And I keep coming back to this because it just feels like the Lakers are starting these games in this hole of, even last night, they play the first 5 minutes of the game with the starters, minus two. Then first 5 minutes, 6 minutes of the third quarter with the starters, minus two again. And it's like they continue to be down 2 points, 4 points, 6 points with this starting group. And I think it's just, it's gotten to the point where, yes, we don't have enough of a sample size with the LeBron in particular starting group, but we have enough sample size of Ayton and Rui in particular have not been good together. It's been a really problematic two-man combination defensively. Ayton wasn't out there last night, but just I just feel like they're leaving a lot of points on the table. And whether it's Marcus or Jake or even Gabe, I think Gabe, is since he's come back, has been impactful defensively to a degree. Like, I just think they need that fifth player to bring a certain level of defense and energy that Rui is just not bringing right now. And it's also marginalizing Rui. Like, Rui has not been the same in terms of shot attempts. And last night, I thought it was interesting that he only got 2 3-pointers. And like, if Rui's out there playing 30 minutes and only getting 2 threes, that is sort of like that's an offensive thing. But it's also like, are there ways to maximize him and use him in better, you know, spots? So I just think that to me has been the trickle down effect of LA's continually in these holes early that they have to play their way out of. And I think it's encouraging that they have the resilience to play their way out of. But I would like to just see something change where we don't see these slow starts every single night, because at this point it feels like you could just bank it that again, Luka drops 24 and they're down by one at the end of the first quarter. Like, that shouldn't be happening.
Yeah, agreed. And that was part of the reason why Lakers fans actually came out of the first quarter, despite as exciting as it was, and Luka's scoring streak being as incredible as it was, a little bit frustrating, because how do you get all that and then you're still down one? Jason, is that where you land to? Do you think this speaks to a shift in the starting lineup? I mean, I guess this brings us probably back to where we've been the last couple of weeks, which is the fifth starter's probably not really on the team right now, ultimately. But does this speak to the Lakers need to get off to a hotter start, and therefore to do so, you need to change up the starting lineup? Is that where you land to?
Again, I still maintain that I think it's a combination of both. Like, do I think Rui is the best possible starter for this group? No. And as we've just discussed, like, to me, most of the idea behind starting Rui is more of like a personality, emotional, politic sure. thing in order to keep him mentally engaged. I agree with Jovan that there's a different direction to go. There's, you know, he talked about the defensive duo of Rui and Ayton in particular. I would extend it further to just their, beyond the defensive end, to just their overall energy level. Rui and Ayton are both just kind of guys that don't bring a ton of like natural energy to start games. And so if their stars come out and bring a lackadaisical energy to start games, they just kind of embody that personality themselves. That said, I do think that there's also a personality element with this team that likes to kind of ease their way into games, outscore you for a while, and then finally be like, all right, it's winning time. Let's tighten the screws. And so I think it's just a little bit of both. But I do agree with Jovan. I just think there's a personality dynamic with this team that is very much a let's ease our way into games and let's outscore you. Like, there was a layer of like swarming on the rotations off of the help of Harden in that third quarter, fourth quarter, that was just different than what we saw mm-hmm. to start the game, even from some of the bench groups as the Clippers kind of hung tight through most of the first half of that game. So, like, again, I just think it's both ultimately.
Now, when you're talking about like an energy and swarming defense and all of those things, I mean, the guy who characterizes that is, well, I don't know if we've talked about it yet, but Jared Vanderbilt. But a lot of fans asking on a nightly basis, is it right that Jared Vanderbilt is not part of the rotation? Does that speak to, should they dust him off and give him some opportunities? Or do you think him being out of the rotation is the correct decision, despite, you know, what we're talking about here in terms of the slow starts on the defensive side of the ball and all of that?
His opportunity might come. Like, I mean, it's one of those things too, where like, so let's say for instance, the Lakers do make a roster balancing trade where they flip Rui for some sort of small forward and they don't include Vando in that trade, which who knows, he might end up getting included. But it's one of those things where whoever this theoretical three is, let's call it Herb Jones, just for the sake of argument, he's going to take minutes away from the Marcus Smart group, from the Jake LaRavia group. And what's going to happen is a lot of those minutes that Rui has been getting spelling LeBron as the backup four, as they've been kind of staggered, some of those minutes might become available. And that could be something that a guy like Jared Vanderbilt could slide into. However, in the current structure of the rotation, there's not a guy that I saw out there yesterday where I was like, let's get him out for Vando. Let's just put it that way.
Even yeah, with I mean, Gabe putting up doing the captain cardio thing, the zeros across the board.
I don't like taking too much from the on-off stuff, especially with like a relatively small sample size. Gabe hasn't even played double-digit games yet, but the Lakers are outscoring opponents by 9 points per 100 possessions with Gabe on, and it's actually been an offensive thing where they're almost 11 points per 100 possessions better offensively with Gabe. That is not the case with Vando. I think the issue with Vando continues to be he's regressed four consecutive years as a finisher. If you look at his finishing within 3 feet of the basket, it went from low 70s to high 60s, dropped again, and then this year it's in the low 60s. So the fact that you don't trust him to like catch a pass on the move and convert a layup, and the fact that like you can't really trust him in the dunker spot. If you are using him in the middle of the floor as a screener, you are now marginalizing DeAndre Ayton and Jackson Hayes, who are both much better screeners, rollers, and finishers than Vando. It's like there's just not really a spot for him offensively. And then I also think defensively, he's been solid to good on most nights, but I don't think he's been quite as impactful as he has been in previous seasons. So it's like he'd have to be defending at like an all defense level, in my opinion, to offset some of the offensive limitations. He's not been at that level. And then you also like there's also just a stylistic thing of LA with how much they switch that negates some of his value defensively, and then offensively again with the way that the offense is set up, I don't see a clear role for him offensively. So I think he's probably on the outskirts for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I agree. And I've largely been a defender of Gabe Vincent, despite calling him Captain Cardio and all of that. But because there's a Tony level Snell. Of trust. Exactly. But there's a level of trust, too, from the coaching staff with Gabe, because you know that he's more often than not, he's going to make the right rotation at the right time. He's going to be in the right spot. He's going to be doing what he needs to do out there on the floor. And you're not going to have to worry about, oh, no, he completely blew this play and was not paying attention and just got lost or anything like that. And there is that reliability factor, I think, with Gabe Vincent. It doesn't always mean that he's going to give you much in terms of counting stats, but I think he does. He's one of those guys that does provide things out there on the floor beyond just counting stats. All right, we do need to get into the Lakers' big three before we get to the questions and comments. They put up 99 points last night. We'll get there in just a moment. We'll be back in 30 seconds. Just going to give a shout out here to our sponsor. Don't go anywhere, everybody. We will be right back.
Sleeper is the number one fantasy sports app. It pays to know sports. Pick more or less on top players. Your first pick is on us, so start winning now. Play in Texas, Georgia, Minnesota, and 27 more states. Pick anytime across all sports, pregame or live. Over 10 million players are already on Sleeper. Make your picks count. Score up to 1,000 times your cash. Join today. Get up to $100 credit using the code HMA. Call your shot on Sleeper. Download now.
All right. And again, guys, make sure you use the link in the description down below. Go check out Sleeper. We appreciate you guys helping our channel continue to grow, our show continue to grow, supporting us. Use that code HMA and use the link in the description down below. Don't forget, while you're down there, hit the subscribe button too. And don't forget to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts as well. All right, guys, the big three. last night. LeBron, Austin, Luka, absolutely fantastic. 99 points combined. LeBron, 25, 6, and 6. Luka, just 43, 9, and 13. Good Lord. Austin Reeves, 31, 9, and 3. Jovan, let's start with you. What are we seeing from the synergy now, three games in, between the Lakers' big three of Austin, LeBron, and Luka?
They just come at you in waves, and I thought that was really the story last night, where we know Luka, his first quarter numbers are well established. Like, he dominates first quarters and likes to set a tone, where Luka, the scorer, then unlocks everything else offensively for his teams, because then it becomes Luka, the playmaker. And we saw, especially in that fourth quarter, the Clippers were just selling out, trapping and blitzing him, and they were reluctant to do that consistently. They were really fighting hard to get around screens or even to switch them, and then eventually just became, well, we're going to have to get the ball out of Luka's hands, and that created those 4-on-3 and 3-on-2 opportunities. So I think last night was, for me, the blueprint of how this group could play moving forward. I still think there are wrinkles that they can unlock in terms of the actual, like, three-man game between those three. I don't think that is fully developed yet. And even seeing some of their stack actions or three-man actions in the middle of the floor, like horn sets and stuff, they're still, like, a little clunky by, you know, by where I think it could be. But I think in terms of each guy getting a segment, like, again, Luka had the first quarter and really the first half, because he scored 32 of his 43 in the first half. And then you have LeBron, I thought, started to be as aggressive as we've seen him up to this point in the season in that third quarter, getting downhill and testing Ivica Zubac's foot speed and looking more comfortable attacking him off the dribble and getting, you know, he had several left side finishes. And then you had Austin with the 18 in the fourth. So I thought it was there was like a patience with Austin and LeBron in terms of like letting Luka cook and then those guys being more selective with when they attacked. But I think there's still like levels to that they could get to even higher in terms of like the actual fit with those guys. Like Luka, you know, still developing that with LeBron, and I think he and Austin have, obviously the offensive rating has been great when those two are on the floor together. But like LeBron and Austin have the institutional knowledge of playing together now for five seasons, so they have that two-man chemistry down, and I think we saw that in the fourth. But I think it still can get even better, which is the crazy thing. Like, I thought last night everybody shot the ball well, and they each had, you know, their solos, right? Kind of like our show. But it just, you know, I still think like the three-man chemistry could be even better.
Jason, where are you at? We're going to start getting the big three analogies coming in the chat now. Jason, where are you at with the three of them together? I am noticing, I'm just digging into some of the on-off numbers here. Luka, LeBron, Austin on the floor together are actually a minus 13 so far on the season. Is that cause for concern at all?
So that was mainly driven by the Jazz game. They were dominant when the three of them were on the floor together against the Clippers yesterday. I don't have the number in front of me, but it was like plus 16 net against the Clippers. So, I mean, predictably, when you have a stretch like the tail end of the game against Utah where they give up a quick whatever that was, like 9-0 run where they damn near lost against Utah, that's going to skew some numbers. And then obviously the starting group getting off to such a bad start. But they looked much better against the Clippers. To me, you know, when you look at the what did they combine for? 99 points yesterday, if I remember correctly. So Luka and Austin, just kind of take them and set them to the side for a second, because a certain amount of that has been stuff we've discussed to death to start the season. The two of them have just been awesome. And like Austin, I thought, had one of his best games of the season yesterday on both ends of the floor, super intense on defense, and then was just really attacking Zubac downhill and pick and roll in the second half, which was causing some serious problems for the Clippers. Luka, just the usual dominance mixed in with now having his step back three going. That's how he's going to get into his, you know, mid-40s types of scoring games. The interesting thing to me is LeBron had 25. And what stood out the most to me is that 25 almost entirely came in a couple of like designed plays for him and then him attacking off an advantage. One of the things that I've noticed, and this has been part of what has allowed Luka and Austin to stay in such a great rhythm while LeBron has been rejoining the team, is when they get into just their kind of like flow basketball, meaning like they're not running a set, but like the first action didn't work and now we're just playing. LeBron's not taking many of those possessions. He's had a few of them, but for the most part, he's pitching it to Austin and he's going to the weak side, and he's operating as a spacer. He's allowing those guys to kind of operate more of that natural flow of the game. And then he's being super aggressive in these very specific spots in what appears to be like designed plays run by JJ. And so a couple of examples from what we saw yesterday. We saw quite a bit of LeBron Jackson pick and roll, but for the most part, it was ran out of a designed action. They kept running this action where LeBron would basically catch at the left elbow extended in a triple threat, not at the three-point line, but rather inside the three-point line. Jackson would set a weak side flare screen for Austin, and then he would run over into the ball screen. LeBron came off of one, hit a soft switch jump shot against Zubats at the left elbow. Then another one where he kind of dragged him a little bit further through the lane and knocked down a kind of a drifting jump shot over his left shoulder. They had another kind of action where it was like essentially a weak side flare screen that operated like a pick and roll that was designed play. LeBron attacks down the angle. That's when he hit the little left-handed bank shot over Zubats at the basket. They ran a couple of those textbook off-ball sets that they've been running throughout the season. So that one that we keep seeing Jake LaRavia get buckets on, where he runs up and sets a back screen, the switch, has inside position, slips to the basket. LeBron got an and one on a play just like that at the tail end of the third quarter, where he set the back screen, got the switch, inside seal, pitched it, drove into the basket, and got the and one layup early in the game. They had a play where he set, it's very reminiscent of, if you guys watched that Houston-Orlando game where Şengün got the left shoulder hook that tied the game at the buzzer, where Şengün operated as a screener to trick everybody into thinking he's screening, and then he just quick turned and sealed. LeBron had a very similar play where he set like kind of a screen on the baseline, quick turned and sealed. They fronted him. Luka threw a beautiful over-the-top pass. He got an and-one layup. These are all buckets that he was getting like in designed actions that JJ is calling, essentially like, all right, LeBron, you attack here. Whereas if they're ever in the flow, he's just deferring to the main guys. And that is allowing him to kind of get his opportunities to score without being problematic to the rhythm of Luka and Austin. And then you add in all of the scoring with the advantage, right? This is where you're seeing the transition pushes. LeBron has been a revelation for the Lakers' transition offense. They started the season averaging less than 20 transition points a game. They were bottom five by every single measure in transition offense. In the last three games, they're averaging 28 transition points per game per synergy. That's roughly a top five pace. He's brought that transition element to it. The weak side scoring, the like, Austin's running a ball screen and you tag the roller and you pitch it over to him and LeBron can knock down a jump shot in the mid-range. Driving a closeout, that second floater he hit on Zubats, that's all that was. Luka pitches him the ball, he rips a closeout, gets to the basket, makes a little floater off the glass. And so that's really the balance here that's working really well for this team, is LeBron is just letting Luka and Austin do their thing. And then in these pivotal kind of like designed actions that JJ's calling, he's looking to be aggressive, and then he's doing a lot of damage in the flow as an off-ball scorer. And that is the formula that's going to make this work ultimately in the big picture because of how versatile LeBron is.
So in other words, Jovan, it sounds to me like LeBron is actually going out of his way to preserve the Lakers' chemistry and he's not destroying it. What? Who I was knew? Told the opposite was going to happen.
Who knew? Who knew LeBron was a selfless player?
Right? Exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, that's all very encouraging stuff, of course, that we are seeing LeBron in those actions, deferring to those other guys, keeping the rhythm of the team, just fitting right in, playing whatever role. He's talked about that, about how he can play whatever role the team needs him to. And that's one of the great things about LeBron James. It's the versatility that I think he really is allowed to now finally show. We've seen in so many years before, LeBron had to have the ball. The ball needed to be in his hands because that was the team's best chance to win. Now that's not so. Now he can just fill in whatever role the team needs in that moment. If they need him to score, he can score. They can run plays to get him to score. But there's other guys that can freelance with the ball that can do what they need to do there to create looks and finish plays for the Lakers, which is fantastic to see.
Really quick, one other quick thing. Yeah, they didn't really run this against the Clippers very much. There was one where LeBron had it on the left block and then Rui beat John Collins on a back cut and LeBron hit him for a quick dunk. But for the most part, it wasn't too much of an option yesterday, but LeBron's been doing a ton of damage in the post to start this season. He's ran 13 post-ups, according to Synergy, and generated 22 points, including passes. It's a 169 offensive rating, which is, like, insane. So, that, again, not as much of a factor against the Clippers, but that's been one of the other kind of random play types. And very similarly, usually by design, they'll work the ball up the floor, and early in the clock, they'll have LeBron come off of some sort of action to get a switch or to get deeper post position. They'll throw the ball down to him there, and then he'll either just score one-on-one or make a simple read when they react to him.
You know, one of the things that I've noticed as well with this group on the floor is I do think when we talk about defensively, especially when we're talking about the starting lineup, right, and should Marcus Smart be the starter, should be Rui Hachimura, because the Lakers' three main guys defensively have some weaknesses. I did notice last night the Clippers, rather than switch on Austin, they were switching Austin off of James Harden so that they could attack Luka, so they could attack occasionally even LeBron in those situations. Jovan, what have you made of the trio defensively, and have you picked up on the advanced metrics bear it out as well? Have you picked up on off or defensive improvements from Austin Reeves?
Yeah, Austin has been one of the most impactful defenders for the Lakers this season in terms of on off, and you know, I'm sure there's some level of noise with some of that, but I mean, I was asked this question last night at the end of the chat in it, or my show. It was 2 a.m. so I wasn't maybe thinking clearly, but someone said, like, first they said Austin's an underrated defender, which I agree with, and people at like he's a sieve when that's just not the reality. But then they're like, is Austin the best defender in the starting group? And I had to think about it, and I'm not sure. I mean, the numbers would suggest that, or at least he's the most impactful defender in terms of the defense. I think Ayton has been solid, even though the rim protection numbers with him on the floor have not been good. And LeBron, of course, we know about his ceiling defensively. But I think Austin has a case to that to some degree. And I mean, his individual numbers continue to be really impressive on the defensive end. So yeah, I mean, they got to figure it out. And I think that said, like, I don't want him as the primary guy. And there was just some possessions last night where I'm looking at, like, Rui's guarding Kawhi and Austin's guarding James Harden. And I'm like, this is not the way that the Lakers should be matching up with other elite scorers, right? Like, you should not have Rui as your primary wing stopper and Austin as your primary point of attack guy. And that's where, again, I think it looked much better. I thought Jake LaRavia had some really great possessions defensively against, in general, but specifically against Kawhi. Marcus came in and was pressuring James Harden, and obviously a couple of the replay situations were direct, you know, collisions between Marcus and James Harden. But like, there's just an element of defensive presence that right now the bench is providing, but I think it's okay for like, JJ loves his offensive starting group and his Banshees coming off the bench. It's okay to have a Banshee with the starting group and add, you know, add one of those shooters and scorers to the bench group. That's where I think, again, it's all about balance here. And I think just swapping a defensive player in for an offensive player, specifically Rui, I think that makes a ton of sense. And you can even play Marcus less than Rui, right? Like, Rui can still play 28, 30 minutes off the bench. Marcus is maybe even 22 to 24 minutes as a starter. But like, I just think it's going to set a certain tone with the starting groups.
Yeah. And I'm with you on Marcus Smart starting. I do think there is an element to it though, where Smart is, it's an easier sell to Marcus Smart that, hey, you're going to be our guy off the bench, as opposed to Rui. I think Rui has talked about in the past that he wants to be in the starting lineup, that he prefers to start. I think it matters more to Rui Hachimura. So maybe there's that little bit, that mental side of it. If you take Rui and put him on the bench, do you get a worse version of him? Perhaps that's part of the decision-making with JJ Redick. But ultimately, I agree with you. I'm on the side of start.
At some point, it has to be about what's best for the team. And like,
exactly.
It's not the starting group, regardless of the combination, that they've either been negative or like slightly positive. And we talked about it last week. Denver, OKC, and Houston are killing people with their starters. I would like to see the Lakers start killing people with theirs.
100%. And here's the thing. Like, we get people in the chat that are saying, like, oh, you're scapegoating Rui. Why do you hate Rui? Nobody hates Rui. Rui's great. Rui's shooting 48% from three. Rui, last I looked, was a top three three-point shooter percentage-wise in the NBA. It's just about what groups are going to fit. How do you put the puzzle pieces together? That's all. We want all these guys to be successful, to be awesome, to be fun, because we like talking about fun basketball. Nobody wants these guys to not be successful or to try to scapegoat anybody or anything like that. We want all these guys to be good. It's just a matter of assembling the puzzle pieces in the right way.
He's very clearly been the odd man out early in the LeBron era. Since LeBron's joined the team, Rui has looked kind of like the guy that's marginalized for predictable reasons, like we talked about before LeBron ever came back. By the way, 17 minutes of LeBron, Luka, and Austin yesterday, a 142 offensive rating and a plus 17 net rating.
That'll work. That'll work. That'll get it done. That's for sure. All right, guys, let's get into some of our super chat questions here to round out the show. We'll go kind of rapid fire here. We got a little later in the show than I realized. Trev, Jason, and Jovan, you guys are great. I'm subbed to all three channels, so thank you. We appreciate that. Any trades to get the Lakers to the finals, and what do they need to improve upon? I mean, guys, I think this kind of goes back into their fifth starter probably is not on the team right now, and ultimately you're prioritizing defense, athleticism, shooting on the perimeter. Is it, I've been talking about this on my show a lot, that I would, in a perfect ideal world, like to see them get somebody who's defending twos and threes and another person who's capable of defending at least threes and fours, if not twos through fours. Are you guys in that like ideal world they're landing those two players?
Yeah, as a swing forward that can slot between LeBron and Luka, that's a starter. Someone in that Herb Jones, Andrew Wiggins type of class. That, and then as far as what do they need to improve on, that and then Austin and Luka's catch and shoot shooting. If those two things, I think, were accomplished before the end of the season, I would consider them firmly on the same tier as like Denver and Houston as legitimate upset threats against Oklahoma City.
Pretty much echo everything you guys have said. I think it... ideally, a player who could defend one through three. So on a given night, they could defend the top ball handlers. Like if you're playing an elite all-star level point guard, they could defend that player, but then they could also defend most wings. And then if you need a four defender, I think I'm fine with LeBron or even Luka in some contexts is taking, you know, that matchup on. So I think it to me, it's really the one through three. Like they have struggled against speed and athleticism, and adding a Herb Jones type or someone like that who can corral those types of players, that would be my preference.
All right, let's go here. Guys, Luka is a Laker. No way this is real. When you see him going berserk in the first, there's times where you still go, man, how did this? Thank you, Nico. Thank you, Nico.
That late third quarter stretch, that's the thing that always gets me excited. Like when he really stops like messing around, like because mess around Luka is dominant too and obviously super exciting, but when Luka gets dead serious about getting great shots, he's like such a force to be reckoned with.
Hey, did you guys, speaking of Luka, did you guys like fist pump the way I did when Jackson Hayes ran over and shoved Chris Dunn? Like that's from a team perspective. That's my guy. I'm going to kick your ass if you're going to have something to say to him. I love that mentality from Jackson Hayes.
Well, and it was the double whammy because like Chris Dunn shoves Luka on the ground on the box out, then jams the basketball into his chest. Like somebody had to do something and Jackson got in there. Good for him.
I loved it.
Loved it. All right. This one says, hi from Slovenia, guys. Best show out there. If the playoffs started today, what would be the best and worst matchup for the Lakers, not counting OKC? So if the playoffs were to start today, the Lakers are the 2 seed. And let's just say if just as chalk in terms of the play-in tournament, that would put the Lakers against the Wolves in round one yet again. What is the best matchup right now in the Western from the realistic playoff team? So like right now, Memphis is a play-in team. We're going to assume like they bow out and such.
I like them. Let's look at just the top tier here. Like the way they match up with Denver just simply because of the fact that LeBron is consistently giving Jokic issues in pick and roll. And then Luka like eviscerated Denver in pick and roll at the tail end of last season. I just think they're going to be able to score against Denver's defense pretty easily. The team that I'm worried about among that top tier, not counting Oklahoma City, is actually Houston. One, just that physical, overwhelming athleticism that can be a little bit of a problem. And then we saw this a little bit with the Minnesota series last year, but like Houston's going to do a lot of switching bigger players onto Luka and LeBron in particular, and they're going to be like, we'll live with these step back threes. And I just worry sometimes about LeBron and Luka attacking some of the bigger athletes that Houston has. I think, again, that's not to we're going to see him play on Christmas Day, and we'll have a much better feel for what that matchup mm-hmm. looks like. But on paper, that's one that concerns me a little bit.
The best for me in terms of the lower tier teams would be Phoenix. I still, I think it's a really good story, and their defense has been impressive. And you got to give Jordan Ott a lot of credit for going in there and changing a culture that's been difficult to change based on the coaching turnover over the last few seasons. But I still like looking at their offensive hierarchy. If Dylan Brooks and Grayson Allen are your number two and number three options, I would want to face that team in the playoffs. But if we're looking at the top, I'm in agreement. I think Houston is the worst matchup for LA because they're athletic, they're big, they are one of the best offensive rebounding teams of all time. And the Lakers have actually been a good defensive rebounding team, but in some of their losses or some of the games where maybe they've underperformed, one of the trends has been giving up a ton of offensive rebounds. So again, we talked about the center situation and how they match up with physical bigs like an Adams or a Şengün. That's where I think Adams could have a field day against them. Houston's also a team that runs a lot of zone, and the Lakers have still at times struggled with facing zone defenses that are pretty good. So I think Houston checks a lot of the boxes of a team that could give the Lakers trouble on paper, especially with Şengün leveling up, Amen Thompson leveling up. And then you have KD as the failsafe option who can frankly just shoot over any Lakers defender, including Marcus Smart, if you want to put him on him. Like they just don't have a great matchup, I think, for KD or Şengün. I know LeBron and Rui have had some success against him, but I think Şengün in 2025 is a different player than he was in previous seasons. And then Denver, we saw what they did against Denver last year, go in there, blow them out, go in there without Luka and LeBron, have that game where Austin drops 41, goes down to the wire against Denver's regulars. And then they had the one game in LA where Denver was shorthanded, but so were the Lakers. So I believe they went 2-1 against Denver post Luka trade. So Denver would probably be the matchup outside of, of course, playing Phoenix, who I think right now projects as probably the weakest in the top eight.
Yeah, I'm in complete agreement with you guys. I got Phoenix is the team that you'd prefer to see. Houston, look, we've seen the Lakers for years now struggle against teams that have size, that have physicality, that have athleticism. And so in Houston has all of that stuff. And it can be so demoralizing playing that team because sometimes their best offense is just to shoot it and get the offensive rebound. And it's so they're so damaging in the NBA. Offensive rebounds are, and they are so good at it. So Houston is a tough matchup. I don't mind that there's a little bit of PTSD lingering from the Denver playoff matchups, but I don't necessarily mind the Denver matchup for them. Houston is a no. San Antonio is an interesting one as well. All comes down to Wemby, of course, but assuming everybody is fully healthy, that's a team where I wonder if the Lakers' experience can overcome the overwhelming presence that can be Victor Wembanyama. So that would be an interesting matchup as well for the Lakers, but it's Houston that I think is the biggest concern as we look at things right now here, a day before Thanksgiving. A lot of basketball left to play, obviously.
Well, OKC is the biggest concern.
Well,
for everybody.
I'm teasing.
I think we're going to get a bonus game against OKC here in a couple weeks for the in-season tournament. And I think that's going to be a very good opportunity for the Lakers to cleanse everybody's psyche after that destructive performance six games ago.
Speaking of which, the Super Chat said, do you see any hope, even with the best version of the Lakers, that there's any shot of beating OKC in the next decade? Feels like this impending doom. Love where we're at, but can't stop thinking about it. I mean, I'm seeing the conversation online. And look, fans tend to, we ride the roller coaster, the highs, the lows, all of that. I've seen people say, you know what, might as well just rebuild for the next decade. And then by then, OKC might start falling off. And then we can start trying to win games again. I don't know, like, I don't think the one game they played so far, it was bad. They got their butts kicked. There's no question. But I don't look at that one game and just say, that's it. It's all over. They can never, ever, ever possibly beat this Thunder. Thunder are very good, and your margin for error against them is zero. But I don't look at them and say, you could never possibly have any shot at beating this team.
They have, in theory, what you need to compete against Oklahoma City, which is big, strong playmakers that can bully their smaller guards and pass through their aggressive defense. Didn't work six games ago because Luka and Austin both had disastrous games. They both are capable of playing much better. LeBron joins that equation. Like, I would never view them as more than a puncher's chance threat in a series like that, but I do think they are a puncher's chance threat despite how bad they looked in that game 6 games ago.
Next decade is aggressive here, but I'm going to make two quick points, and I'm going to reiterate points I made earlier in the show. This is where I think the starting lineup actually matters, because you go down 12-4 to OKC and you're basically dead with the way that they play. Like, you need to be in that game at all times. And the second they start to distance themselves from you, that's where you're on the ropes. So I do think the starting group against OKC in particular will matter. Every possession against OKC will matter. And then to the larger point that Jason was hitting on earlier with the net rating and the Lakers' personality with this group, like, this is where I think it can be a little concerning, because it's like the Lakers don't have, they have not roped together a lot of games and even stretches in games of serious, like, locked in basketball for a full quarter, a full half. I think the Charlotte game was the textbook example of this, where they messed around in the first half. They tried in the third quarter, that won them the game. And then they tried, like, for a couple of stretches within the fourth. So, like, they kind of tried for like a quarter and a half in that game, and they won by 10. And it was like, just like, they did just enough studying to pass the test with like a B+. And the, you know, I made this analogy last night on my show, where like OKC is studying 5 hours a night, every single night. They are getting A+. Their worst grade on the season is a 97, and they are crushing every quiz, every test. And it doesn't matter who's in for them. Like, Shea doesn't play in the fourth, and they don't give up 20 point leads. They actually extend it to 30. Whereas the Lakers have blown multiple double digit leads this season that they end up still winning the game, but like, then it gets a little shaky there. So my big thing for LA is, like, I would like to see more sustained periods of concentration, because I do believe habits are important, and the turning it on, you can't just turn it on against OKC. You have to be locked in for all 48 minutes. And we just have not seen that yet from LA consistently.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. We have not seen a full 48 minutes from them where they are locked into the entire game. We've seen ebbs and flows throughout every game. They had that horrible second quarter against Memphis. They turned it on against the Clippers in last night's game. They have not been able to dial it in for all 48 minutes yet, and that's what it does take. So some more study time for the Lakers is what you're saying. They've got to really make sure they really hit the books in order to stay locked in here. All right, let's go here. Dream target would be Kamara or Avdija. Well, Kamara, I believe, is not traded.
I hate to break it to you guys, neither of those are ever happening.
No. And neither guy's available, even if they were. But Kamara's not even trade eligible for the season. And then Avdija, they're not moving him. Who do you think is most realistic if we gave everything we could outside the big three? Love you, MFers. And then this makes a lot. This one makes a lot more sense when you get his follow-up super chat in here. You three together are genuinely great. This morning, Jay is hitting, but I really think you three talking Lakers/NBA could lead to huge things. I'm outie.
Yeah, I'm glad you're enjoying your holiday week, dude. That sounds like a ton of fun.
We need to bring this guy on the show. We need to... that's this guy's having a great day.
Yeah, dude, I'm really happy for you. The morning Jay's giving you some delusions of grandeur as it pertains to these young Portland stars, but when you talk about Tamani Kamara, to me, just think of Herb Jones. Herb Jones is just like that type of player, that kind of like 6'8", rangy, multi-positional defensive wing that can knock down a three and drive a closeout. Ideally, you got to just change your gears towards teams that are in the depths of the NBA rather than, you know, to me, Portland is very much building something exciting for the future. So I just think they're in a different part of their, like, willingness to sell, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that guy is definitely going to like the call out of Herb Jones.
I was going to say, Herb Jones, not to be confused with a strain of something. that's a good one.
All right, let's go here. What's the most you guys would give up for each? Keon Ellis, Trey Murphy, Dylan Brooks, Herb Jones, Andrew Wiggins. Do we really want to? I mean, this is just kind of all the expirings, Rui in or out of trades and draft picks, right? I mean, and Dalton Connect. I don't know how much value he's got left at this point, but that's kind of the Lakers' default trade package. Maxi, Gabe, Dalton Connect being the baseline. And then if they really want to go all in, then we're talking Rui.
Trey and Herb are the only ones I'd give up a first-round draft pick for. Keon and Dylan, I think it would be like a opportunistic, like, oh, it's a – the thing with Keon is I think he's a little too slow. And then with Dylan, I'm just not sure he fits at the big picture goals of the team, kind of into that Wiggins tier of like, man, yeah. I'm not sure if you want to give up substantial draft compensation for an imperfect option. But if Trey Murphy or Herb Jones, both of those guys would be wonderful spots. Or fillers of that three spot in between Luka and LeBron. And those are caliber of players that are such substantial influxes of talent that you'd have to consider giving up a protected first round pick. What about you, Jovan?
I mean, I would love any of these guys on the team thinking about it. Mm-hmm. I agree in Trey and Herb as being the two guys that I would give up first for. Wiggins is borderline for me, but I get why they'd be reluctant based on the age and the contract. I would give up Rui for Trey and Herb for sure, and probably Wiggins. I think the ideal trade outcome for LA is keeping Rui and just moving him to the bench. And if there's any way to combine Gabe, Maxi, Dalton, and even the first, or you know, second swaps, whatever, if you can just get that fifth guy and then have your 6 through 8 be Rui, Marcus, and Jake, I think that's an incredible outcome for LA and really does put them on that OKC. Or not, like, no one's touching OKC, I think, on paper, but it definitely puts you on par, if not higher, potentially, than Denver and Houston, in my opinion. But yeah, Keon, I do, it's tough with the salary. I'd do like Dalton in a second. And I don't know if you could give much more for that. Trey, I actually don't think they have enough for, based on the price that New Orleans has been asking for. They said they want 1 to 2 like blue chip young guys plus 2 picks. So the Lakers cannot offer either of those. They have 1 pick to trade until the offseason. And then
what a crazy price for a blue chip young guy.
Yeah. I mean, and then, you know, Brooks and Wiggins, I think that's more so. I mean, with Brooks and Wiggins, they might not even be available. Miami's 3rd in the East right now. Phoenix mm-hmm. is 6th in the West. Like, I'm not trading either of those guys if I'm those two teams respectively. So that's why, like, we've talked a lot about different players, but one thing I've tried to be consistent in going back to the offseason, but into the season now, has been like, we just don't know where things are going to be at in December, January, and February with all these teams, right? Like, so much of it comes down to the context of their situation. And if Miami and Phoenix are top 6 teams in their respective conferences, like, Brooks and Wiggins are probably not available, like, that because they're actually trying to compete.
A random stat I found this morning, Oklahoma City does not, in fact, have the best half court defense in the NBA right now. The Miami Heat do.
Really?
Yeah, I was surprised when I saw that this morning.
That is surprising. Okay, ultimately, where I land on these guys is I see 4 of them as if you trade for them. And by the way, on Wiggins, I am Rui or the first. I wouldn't want to do Rui and a first for
not
Wiggins.
Both for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I wouldn't do both those. But Herb Jones, great. Trey Murphy, obviously great if there's a way you can get him. But Keon Ellis, I would set aside from this group and make him, he's more like the bonus, right? Like the other 4, you can get those guys and say, okay, this is our 5th starter. I don't know that that's going to be true for Keon Ellis just yet, if I can go to that level. And I've been a big proponent of his, but I don't think I can quite go to that point just yet where you say that's locked in, he's your 5th starter. The other guys, I think you probably can, but again, much more interest in Murphy and Herb Jones than the other ones. All right, let's go here. Thoughts on the closing lineup last night? Could we see us going to that even with Ayton healthy? Let's Rui play bigger and makes us unguardable. I mean, Jason, you've been pulling up the great stats on the Lakers' fourth quarter performance. What did you see last night from that closing group?
Yeah, you know, Jackson was out there for most of it, and then they did go to a centerless group at the very end, and Jackson made a couple of amazing short roll reads. He had that lob to Rui along the baseline, and then he had another one where he hit Austin in the corner for a closeout attack that he finished. Ultimately, I think back to what happened at the end of the Jazz game where we saw Gabe and Maxi out there. And ultimately, that to me is kind of the luxury of this version of the Lakers. They don't have this obvious option at the 3, but what they do have is just a bunch of different types of guys. Like if you need a center that is a really good short roll passer because Luka's getting blitzed, then Jackson's a good option. If it's more of like you're facing more traditional coverages and you need someone that, or switching, and you need someone that can either beat a switch or hit some tougher jump shots there in the middle of the floor, Ayton's a good option. Ayton's also a better kind of like traditional drop coverage big and a better rebounder. If you need like more of just a versatile, switchy, kind of pretty good at everything option, Maxey's there. Or like you mentioned, a small lineup with Rui and LeBron basically operating at the four and the five. And then at that three spot, Gabe, obviously in the Utah game, a kind of a speedy guard that could also switch a little bit and got some big stops against Lauri Markkanen and can knock down a catch and shoot three. Marcus obviously doesn't bring the catch and shoot shooting, but he brings that just defensive playmaking and overall connective playmaking and just kind of all around offensive skill. Jake Laravia brings a certain skill set. Rui brings a certain skill set. What I kind of imagine this team being until they make some sort of more aggressive trade is basically LeBron, Luka, and Austin, and what are the two right guys for this matchup? And it looking different kind of a night-by-night basis. And then if you get in Herb, let's just say Herb Jones, for example, then yeah, he obviously becomes the guy who ends up being that that fourth dude. But then even then, I could see universes where they're like, they're blitzing and we want Jackson making the short roll reads, so let's go with Jackson. Or, you know, we're going to be doing more switching and Maxey's just a higher floor player, less mistake prone. Let's go with Maxey. Or Ayton's got his, you know, brain engaged tonight. We're riding with Ayton. Like, I think throughout the season, regardless of what happens, there's going to be some variation around those three. And I think that's a luxury. Like, the Lakers don't have a perfect closing five, but they do have a lot of options. And ultimately, as long as JJ plays the right cards, it kind of functionally acts as though you have a defined closing five.
Yeah, I like that. I like that way of looking at it. I think that's ultimately the way they're going to go. And so far, we have seen JJ largely pick the right groups and has pushed the right buttons, as evidenced by the improvements that we've seen in the second halves here for them. All right, let's do the last few here. We'll go rapid fire style here. The last few. Sabre said, should the Lakers let contracts expire or trade them? I mean, it all depends on what's available. Just, I've been making this point a bunch that I'm not saying the Lakers should not make trades or should not do anything to go all in. I do think this team has something here that it is worth investing in when we're talking about future assets, but that return has to be worth it, because we have to factor into any trade that the Lakers make. If they're taking on future salary, you also have to factor in the diminished optionality, as Rob Pelinka likes to say, or flexibility for this coming summer, because they do project to be one of the bigger cap space teams, potentially, depending on how all their contracts play out. But they could be one of the bigger cap space teams out there this summer. Again, not saying the Lakers should not go all in, not saying they need to wait until the summer. It just has to be a factor in their decision making. So if it's a player that they don't think moves the needle, for example, if they don't think Andrew Wiggins changes things very much compared to Rui Hachimura, do you want to have $30 million less to work with this summer in order to turn Rui into Andrew Wiggins? I could see where the Lakers could look at that and say, well, you know, maybe that is worth it, maybe it isn't. But you have to factor in that diminished optionality next summer into your decision-making process. So that's the biggest thing when it comes to should the Lakers let these contracts expire or not. If they're going to trade them, they just have to make sure that it's worth giving up some of the flexibility that they would have had otherwise this summer.
The only thing I would add to that is, like, I think it's easy to sell fans or just like everyone on the notion of free agency and having cap space. But the reality of the situation is free agency has changed over the last few years, and having $60 million in cap space or even $40 million in cap space does not mean you're going to land a star, or does not mean you're going to land even high level starters with that cap space, right? Like, a lot of these situations end up where the player either resigns with their team and then eventually gets traded or has to be traded, or, you know, it's just, I think, so that's the one thing is, I think it's easy to be like, well, they could have this much cap space next summer, and so, like, let the contracts expire and then next summer go sign star player X. If you actually look at who's out there, the names are not the sexiest. And then on top of that, just with how the league has shifted with the new CBA and with the different aprons and whatnot, like, I think in a perfect world, you trade the expiring contracts and you upgrade the roster now and for the future, which is where I think Herb Jones is like the perfect guy. I think he checks the boxes that the Lakers need, and he's locked into an extension for the foreseeable future. So that's the type of trade that you swing for. But of course, to your point, like, you don't just trade just to trade. I think people look at the cap space and they're like, oh, Lakers are going to sign this player and this player. And it's like, potentially, I'm not saying it's impossible, but that's less likely than it was in summers past.
I also think 100%. The only thing that I would add, like, I think LeBron would structure his contract in a way. If there was some obvious guy that was going to obviously come in this summer as a free agent that was going to obviously elevate the team, I think LeBron would structure his new deal to make that work.
Yeah,
at 42 years old.
Exactly. Hey, LeBron, this, you know, he's not a free agent, but look, Giannis wants to come. Will you play for $25 million to bring in Giannis?
Of course. Something
like,
come on,
like that. Like, of course, he's gonna do something like that. But essentially, what Jovan's talking about is the concept of pre-agency, which we saw the Toronto Raptors have been great, and they did use that strategy in going and getting Brandon Ingram and then keeping him on board. Essentially, spent their offseason money at the trade deadline last year. I could see the Lakers doing something similar. That type of strategy. All right. Lakers number one fan said, to save on assets and money, how would you feel about a trade involving Gabe and Connect and a second round pick, first round pick swap to the Nets or Raptors for Haywood Highsmith and Ochai Agbaji? What do you think about those guys as targets?
I think I like both of them. I think ultimately for the Lakers, if they don't hit a home run on a player like the Herb Jones, Andrew Wiggins type of archetype, I think that's what we'll see, is some sort of like subsidiary move for an athlete that comes off the bench. And that ultimately, like we talked about earlier, having the options in the closing group or starting group, it'll just be another option that the Lakers will have to structure lineups. And it'll be just like that. It'll be some salary filler plus a second round pick kind of thing. I think that's what we'll see if they don't end up finding the home run deal.
All right, let's go here. I don't have anything to add to that. So let me go here. What does a trade for Andrew Wiggins look like while not giving up Rui? That gives LA more than a fighter's punch at beating OKC. Gabe Vincent. Yeah, that's where essentially math-wise, you almost have to put Jared Vanderbilt in. It's stacking Gabe and Maxi and then Vando. But that, and I believe you've been talking about this a little bit recently, Jovan, but Vando, I don't see positive. Like, Miami's wouldn't be thrilled with taking on Vando. No team would right now. He's not going to have positive value. So that's where it becomes tough when we just...
If you're putting in Vando to this trade, you're going to have to attach a first-round pick.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which then changes the equation of the trade. Yeah. Right. Vando's contract is going to be very difficult to trade.
Yeah, because he's got the multiple years under contract. All right. Cage said Oubre and Grimes for Gabe, Connect, Adu, and a first. Oubre metrics are better than Herb and Quentin Grimes. I mean, Oubre's played well to start the season, but like, Jason, do you buy what Kelly Oubre's done so far?
You know, I'm not the biggest Kelly Oubre fan. Before he got hurt, he was showing some decent off the dribble pop too, kind of like driving closeouts and making little short jump shots. Had some stretches where he shot the ball well from three. I think Grimes is an interesting guy to keep an eye on, because ultimately, if Philly continues to fall apart like they have over the course of the last couple of weeks, they do have just a glut of guards. And if you kind of look at Jared McCain is not playing well since he's come back from his injury, but like, he should in theory continue to kind of get a little bit more rhythm and start to play a little bit better. There's a version of this where Philly looks at the situation and goes, would I rather pay Jared McCain on a rookie contract when I have VJ Edgecombe and Tyrese Maxey as my like kind of starting backcourt of the future, and Quentin Grimes is going to want some sort of extension? Then Grimes is an interesting guy to reach out to. But ultimately, do I think Quentin Grimes is your starting three of the future? Probably not. And Quentin Grimes is going to want some money. So that then gets complicated in terms of the big picture kind of cap goals for the Lakers. So it's kind of intriguing as like a 1 year kind of like do it and then maybe sign and trade him this summer, something along those lines. But it's just kind of risky because of how much money he's going to want. And Kelly Oubre, to me, is not in the same class of player as a Herb Jones or an Andrew Wiggins. He's not, to me, the kind of guy that's a long-term solution at the three either.
Yeah. I agree. I think Oubre to me is more of a high-level bench wing, and then Grimes, I think, can be a starter, but I don't know if he's that if we look at it through the lens of like, who's the ideal third player to slot next to Luka and Austin in both the short term and long term, I don't think Grimes is that player personally.
I love him for $8 million for 1 year.
Sure. Do you want to pay him $22 million a year?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Right. That's where it gets to be a bit tough. Okay. Everybody, Thanksgiving tomorrow. By the way, I was just looking. Next week, we go 2 days a week. That's coming up.
Do we? That's exciting.
Yeah. It came up fast. So next week, we'll start 2 days a week. We will, guys, we'll put it in the community section. We'll announce like what days specifically. We'll have that conversation, figure out which days we're going to try to lock into. And there may need to be some flexibility in that. But just know, everybody, we're going to be going 2 days a week starting next week. But with that, thank you, everybody, for joining us. Have a wonderful and happy Thanksgiving. Jovan, Jason, as I said last week, this has become one of the highlights of my week for sure. Truly enjoy talking Lakers basketball with both of you. And I hope you guys both have a very, very happy Thanksgiving.
It was great to see you guys. Happy holidays. And everyone in the chat, everyone who has been watching, just thank you so much for supporting the show. It's been really fun to watch this explode over the last month and a half.
Happy Thanksgiving, guys. I am thankful and grateful for you. I'm thankful and grateful for everybody in the chat. Appreciate you all and hope you have a great rest of your week.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you and stay safe.